morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, March 9th, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
I'm Carlos Chavez.
Coming up, Portland General Electric said yesterday it's almost ready to destroy the 499-foot cooling tower at Trojan Nuclear Plant. The House Appropriations Committee voted overwhelmingly yesterday to block the Dubai Ports World deal. And Israel's acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert announced he expects Israel's permanent borders to be drawn by the year 2010. Portland area weather today, in case you haven't noticed, snow, and snow mixed with rain later. Snow showers above 500 feet, temperatures in the upper 30s to lower 40s. Snow advisories throughout the area, mostly at higher elevations. You can log on to OPB's website. They have a complete list of school closings and snow routes for buses. Tonight, chance of snow showers to the north, snow mixed with rain, lows 30 to 40.
Portland General Electric said yesterday it's almost ready to destroy the 499-foot cooling tower at Trojan Nuclear Plant. The structure is scheduled for implosion on May 21st. It is one of the most widely recognized icons of Oregon's only nuclear power plant. The power plant closed in 1993 after 17 years of operation. Since then, PGE has gradually phased out the facilities at the plant, located roughly 40 miles north of Portland on the Columbia River. Trojan is the first large-scale commercial nuclear plant to be decommissioned in the United States, and the cooling tower is the largest to be destroyed. Control Demolition Incorporated, the Maryland-based contractor handling the implosion, said it will take 8 seconds to bring down the 41,000 tons of cement steel. Control Demolition is the company involved in taking down Building 7 on 9/11. The company will place roughly 2,000 tons of explosives at the base of the structure, which is expected to tilt slightly sideways, then collapse upon itself. The structure has also been stripped of all its machinery. Radioactive material was never contained in the tower.
The state of Oregon has fined the company working on chemical weapons disposal in eastern Oregon a paltry $8,800 for violating rules for monitoring emissions. The Department of Environmental Quality said the fines covered two violations, running incinerators for 16 minutes in September without an automatic air monitoring system, and operating a waste unit for 14 hours in August without proper monitoring because a technician failed to reconnect a line. The unit processes waste from the incinerator's air pollution scrubbers, said Dan Dusso, Senior Hazardous Waste Compliance Officer for the DEQ. In both cases, the company was able to submit documents from backup equipment that showed there was no chemical agent in the emissions. The DEQ said in a statement that the company reported the violations in September. Under state rules, it has until March 23rd to appeal the penalties. The company and the U.S. Army use incinerators to dispose of chemical weapons from the nearby Umatilla Chemical Agent Disposal Facility in Hermiston. Figures from the DEQ show that a meager $84,000 in fines have been paid in Umatilla cases dating to 1999. In several cases, fines levied by the agency were later reduced.
Federal fish managers say both commercial and sport salmon fishing from California to Oregon must not be allowed this season. If taken, it would be the first time for such a widespread closure, one that would devastate coastal fisheries and make ocean-caught salmon scarce to the retail buyer. The National Marine Fisheries Service recommendation to the Pacific Fishery Management Council is the only voice that the council must consider as it meets this week in Seattle, but it carries tremendous weight. The council is an advisory board to the Fisheries Service and proposes harvest limit. Salmon fishing along approximately 700 miles of coastline from Oregon's Cape Falcon near Manzanita to California's Point Sur, just south of San Francisco, would be shut down if the recommendation becomes fact. The area affected by the expected closure supplies 96% of the roughly 250,000 salmon caught commercially last year in the ocean off Oregon, according to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. About two-thirds of salmon caught by Oregon fishermen last year in the ocean came from the same area. The reason for the closure is the desperate situation in the Klamath River, where the Fall Chinook Run is dwindling.
This winter's deep snow in the Cascades is a snowboarder's dream, but a new study suggests that ski areas may have fewer such bonanza seasons if northwest temperatures continue to rise as they have for decades. Researchers at Oregon State University identify 19 ski areas in the Cascade and Olympic Mountain areas as being at risk of substantially fewer cold and snowy winters by mid-century. They're projecting warmer weather from a climate model keyed to the Pacific Northwest. They calculate that Mount Hood Meadows Ski Resort, for example, now faces warm winters about 7% of the time, but by 2040 would have warm winters nearly half the time. If the projections prove accurate, lower elevation ski areas would be especially hard hit, going to warmer winters nearly 75% of the time. Past climate studies by others have projected rising temperatures and thinner northwest snowpacks. But this study by OSU geographers Ann Nolan and Christopher Daly is the first to employ a climate mapping system that identifies relatively small areas in the Cascades where snow might disappear entirely. The potential dramatic impact of the findings owes to the transition climate of the Cascades, in which a single degree or two Fahrenheit often is the difference between snow and rain. The same is not true, for example, in the far colder Wallowas in northeastern Oregon. This makes some portions of the Northwest more prone than others to showing symptoms of global warming. This from the Oregonian.
Hundreds of travelers at Portland International Airport wound up in a security sand trap on Tuesday when a piece of high-tech golf equipment touched off anti-terrorism alarms. A Nike golf expert had checked the unassuming hard-sided gray briefcase through to Dallas shortly before noon and left to board his 1:14 p.m. plane before something in his baggage triggered alarms. Transportation security officers evacuated part of the terminal, shut down two of three ticket lobbies, closed traffic lanes in front of the airport, and summoned the Portland Police Bureau's bomb squad. A remote-controlled robot retrieved the case from the baggage scanner, enabling police to see the name tag when the passenger who owned the briefcase was located and hustled back into the terminal. The mystery was finally cleared up. He assured police that it was harmless. The case that had partly shut down the airport for 2.5 hours held a device that uses Doppler radar to record every move of a golf ball in flight. Nike issued a statement later saying the company regretted inconveniencing the travelers and airport personnel and recognized that the law enforcement acted out of concern for the traveling population. This from the Oregonian.
Three Oregon school districts have signed on as plaintiffs in an impending lawsuit over the inadequacy of state school funding, and nearly 20 more are weighing the possibility of joining the lawsuit as well. So far, Pendleton, Eugene, and Crow Applegate Lorain are the districts which have joined. But the large number of districts considering it, about 10% of the 198 school districts statewide, suggests that the lawsuit has generated plenty of interest in a state where battles over school spending are a perennial feature of legislative sessions. Similar lawsuits seeking to force legislators to allocate more money for schools have been filed in 37 states. In 21 cases, the plaintiffs have come out on top. Seven have gone the state's way and nine are still pending.
Oregon's only physician-owned hospital could be kicked out of federal Medicare program if it does not change the way it provides patient care. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services notified Physicians Hospital last week that the Portland Hospital will no longer qualify for Medicare reimbursements because of deficiencies that put patient health and safety in jeopardy. Problems at the Portland Hospital were initially publicized by the Willamette Week newspaper, which reported that a patient, Helen Wilson, died in July 2005 following surgery. No doctors were on site when her heart stopped shortly after surgery, and medical staff had to call 911 for help. The story prompted a federal investigation, which concluded last week. The results have not been made public. The Physicians Hospital will lose its provider contract on March 19. Unless it meets guidelines set out by the federal agency.
The Oregon Department of Human Services will release its 8th annual report on the state's Death with Dignity Act this morning. The Death with Dignity Act allows terminally ill patients to get a prescription for lethal medication. It was a voter-approved initiative that went into effect in 1997. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. public power. Today we have an update from activist and attorney Dan Meek on the ongoing Enron saga.
I am working to finalize the settlement agreement with Portland General Electric to get back $10 million for PGE ratepayers in Multnomah County, which represents the amount that they have been charged from the Multnomah County business income tax by PGE over the last 8 or 9 years since the takeover by Enron, which money was actually never paid to the county. And so we've quantified that at about $7.5 million, and we filed a class action lawsuit against PGE over a year ago. And after various court rulings in our favor during the past year, PGE agreed to give back all of the money plus interest, and there may even be some money left over for charitable purposes at the end, $3 million a year higher than they would otherwise be. In the last session of the Oregon legislature, there was a very curious, unusual coalition of forces that came together in order to pass Senate Bill 408, which is the bill that forbids utilities, as of the first of this year, from charging ratepayers for income taxes that don't actually get paid. It turns out that this is something that not only PGE has been doing, but the other utilities in Oregon have been doing as well, Pacific Power and Light in particular. That is, when it comes to setting their rates, the Oregon Public Utility Commission allows them to assume in the rates that they are paying their full freight when it comes to federal and state income taxes. That is, they simply take their expected net income, add to that 34% to pay federal income taxes, and they add to that 6.5% to pay state income taxes. So we're actually, in our rates, not only paying all of the costs of the utilities, including their exorbitant executive salaries and all of their other costs, but we're also paying for them to obtain a certain level of net income, their reasonable return on investment, but we're also paying for the assumed income taxes that would be paid on that return on investment. That's the number that for PGE was about $93 million a year, and for Pacific Power and Light in Oregon is about $80 million a year.
What all this means is that the money that you paid as taxes on your PG&E bill is vacationing in the Cayman Islands. That was activist and attorney Dan Meek.
The Republican-controlled Senate Select Committee on Intelligence voted to expand oversight of the National Security Agency warrantless surveillance program. Republican members, however, rejected requests from the Democrats to conduct a full-scale investigation into the program. FSRN's Selena Masuta has more.
Members of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence reached an agreement with the White House to create a 7-member subcommittee that would oversee Bush's domestic spying policy, as long as the White House approves of the plan. This falls short of what Democrats had hoped for, which was a detailed investigation of all activities by the National Security Agency after September the 11th, 2001. Brittany Benowitz is a fellow at the Center for National Security Studies.
People on the Hill have said, how can we legislate if we don't know if innocent people are being swept up? I mean, how many people have been swept up in this program? We don't know if it's 1,000 or 100,000. The fact that at the request of the White House, Republican members of the committee refused to have an inquiry and are proceeding with legislation which would authorize the program, which, by all accounts, to date has been operating outside of the law, raises serious questions about whether or not innocent people are being wiretapped.
There is, however, a push within Republican circles to put the presidential policy into the law books. 4 Republican members of the committee, led by Ohio Senator Mike DeWine, have proposed draft legislation known as the Terrorist Surveillance Act of 2006 that would require the White House to provide reasons for eavesdropping warrants that extend beyond 45 days and would include a sunset of 5 years on the program if that were not extended by Congress. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan says that the president is open to working with DeWine.
We want to continue to work with him and others, as I said, on legislation that would codify into law what the president's authority already is. And I think that you're going to be hearing more from members in a short amount of time on some of their ideas.
Not all Republicans support the president's surveillance program, which has drawn criticism for possible civil rights violations. Pennsylvania Republican Senator and Judiciary Chairman Arlen Specter.
I do not think that the legislation is sufficient in permitting the surveillances to continue without warrants, without a determination of constitutionality. That is squarely opposed to the longstanding law prescribed pursuant to the Fourth Amendment prohibiting unreasonable search and seizures to require a magistrate a judicial determination of probable cause.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Selena Masuda for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. has called for extraordinary action to get to the bottom of Iran's nuclear program yesterday as Tehran and Washington moved into confrontational mode in the long-running dispute. This according to The Guardian. The American ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Greg Shultz, called for special inspections by the UN nuclear teams in Iran. The move gives them carte blanche in their detective work at the Vienna meeting of the IAEA board that's reporting Iran to the UN Security Council. The mechanism has been used only once before, unsuccessfully, in North Korea 13 years ago. Capping a long campaign to take the nuclear row to the Security Council, Shultz said the time has now come for the Security Council to act. It should emphasize that Iran will face consequences if it does not meet its obligations. Iran reacted furiously, squaring up to the U.S. and making implicit threats to use oil as a weapon against it. Javad Valadi, the deputy head of Iran's National Security Council, said, "Let the ball roll." He was using the words used against Iran at the weekend by U.S. hawk and ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton. Vaidi said the United States may have the power to cause harm and pain, but it is also susceptible to harm and pain. Despite talk all week of a compromise brokered by the Russians, which could have allowed all sides to save face and resume negotiations, the IAEA meeting ended with positions more entrenched.
Leon County, Florida election supervisor Ion Sancho is alleging a breach of contract after a security test revealed hackable elections are possible on Diebold optical scan systems. E-voting, Monolith, and competitors all refuse to do business with the Florida County unless the elected Ion Sancho is removed from office. Sancho has launched legal breach of contract proceedings against the company. The action has been filed on behalf of the Leon County Supervisor of Elections Office. The breach concerns Diebold's refusal to deliver the latest operating system for the optical scan voting systems, which had previously been used in Leon County until Sancho discovered an alarming security flaw in the system at the end of last year. The only two other voting machine vendors, ESNS and Sequoia Voting Systems, have now officially refused to do business with Leon County and Sancho in the wake of a series of security evaluations held last year in the county on actual Diebold equipment, with the state threatening Sancho with legal action themselves if he is not able to implement a voting system, which requires with the Federal Help America Vote Act, HAVA, Sancho had been forced to attempt to do business again with Diebold. This according to the Raw Story.
And Raw Story again has published a document titled "An Executive Order Detailing Responsibilities of the Department of Homeland Security with Respect to Faith-Based and Community Initiatives." Specifically, the order states that by the authority vested in me as president by the Constitution and the laws of the United States of America, and in order to help the federal government coordinate a national effort to expand opportunities for faith-based and other community organizations and to strengthen their capacity to better meet America's social and community needs, it is hereby ordered as followed. Establishment of a Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives at the Department of Homeland Security. The Secretary of Homeland Security shall establish within the Department of Homeland Security a Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. The center shall be supervised by a director appointed by the Secretary. The Secretary shall consult with the director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives prior to making such appointment. The department shall provide the center with appropriate staff, administrative support, and other resources to meet its responsibilities under this order. It goes on, but you get the picture. This from Raw Story.
A Gallup report released yesterday reveals that more than half of all Americans reject evolution theory and scientific evidence and agree with the statement, God created man equally, how Bible describes it. Another 31% says the man did evolve, but God guided. Only 12% back evolution and say God had no part. Gallup summarized it this way: surveys repeatedly show that a substantial portion of Americans do not believe that the theory of evolution best explains where life came from. They are not so quick to agree with the preponderance of scientific evidence.
Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano has ordered more National Guardsmen posted at the Mexican border to help stop illegal immigrants and so-called illegal immigrants and curb-related crimes. National Guard troops have worked at the border since 1988, but Napolitano signed an order authorizing commanders to station an unspecified number of additional soldiers there to help federal agents. Once the funding is approved, the troops will monitor crossing points, assist with cargo inspection, and operate surveillance cameras according to the order. About 170 National Guardsmen are already posted at the nation's busiest entry point, where they assist with communications, fence construction, and anti-drug efforts. The Democratic governor proposed sending troops to the border more than 2 months ago. Her critics in the Republican-led legislature then introduced a bill requiring her to do so and providing $10 million for the project. The bill won final approval yesterday in the House and was headed to the governor, but she promised to veto the measure, saying it infringes on her constitutional powers as commander-in-chief of the Arizona National Guard. Napolitano has asked the military to pay for her plan, but she said she would commit state dollars if necessary.
Acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said yesterday that he expects to draw Israel's permanent borders by 2010. As part of that effort, Israel plans to build a controversial settlement outside Jerusalem. Olmert's Kadima party is the clear front runner in the March 28th election. In an interview today, Olmert told the Jerusalem Post Daily that within 4 years he intended to, quote, get to Israel's permanent borders, whereby he will completely separate from the majority of the Palestinian population and preserve a large and stable Jewish majority in Israel. Olmert said Israel would act unilaterally to set its borders if Hamas militants didn't renounce their struggle against Israeli occupation and accept the guidelines of an internationally backed peace plan with a reasonable time. Should Hamas resist, he said, we will need to begin to act. Olmert said his broad guidelines for Israel's borders included incorporating its three major settlement blocks, Ma'aleh Adumim and Gush Etzion, outside Jerusalem, and Israel deep in Ariel, deep inside the West Bank. Borders would also include Jerusalem and its immediate environs and the Jordan River Valley, which Olmert characterized as a security border. Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat urged Olmert to return to the negotiating table. Erekat said unilateralism and dictation will only add to the complexities and will not solve problems. Food supplies are dwindling in Gaza's markets 3 weeks after the closure of the area's main crossing point for commercial and humanitarian supplies. FSRN's Leila El-Khaddad reports from Gaza City.
According to the United Nations, Gaza's 1.3 million residents are experiencing severe food shortages as a result of the Israeli-imposed economic closure, now in its third week. The closure began just before the new Hamas-dominated parliament took power. Last month, Israeli Prime Ministerial Advisor Dov Weisglass was quoted as saying that the idea behind the closure policy was to, quote, put the Palestinians on a diet but not make them die of hunger. Flour mills have shut down, dairy products and fruits have virtually disappeared from Gaza markets, and essential supplies are expected to run out by Saturday. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila El-Haddad.
Gunmen wearing commando uniforms of the Shiite-dominated Interior Ministry yesterday stormed an Iraqi security company that relied heavily on Sunni ex-military men from the Saddam regime. They spirited away 50 hostages. The ministry denied involvement and called the operation a terrorist act. Police in the U.S. military, meanwhile, reported finding the bodies of 24 men garroted or shot in the head, most of them in an abandoned bus in a tough Baghdad Sunni neighborhood. They also reported the deaths of at least 13 others across Iraq, including a U.S. soldier and a Marine. A bomb hidden under a parked car detonated as police were driving through Baghdad, killing two officers and wounding a third. And gunmen attacked the convoy of Interior Ministry Undersecretary Hekmet Musa in West Baghdad, killing two bodyguards and injuring two others. The sectarian bloodshed is complicated. Shiite Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari's bid for a second term. Al-Jafari is opposed by a coalition of Sunni, Arab, Kurdish and secular Shiite politicians led by President Jalal Talabani, who is himself a Kurd. The president has openly challenged al-Jafari's candidacy on grounds that he's too divisive and would be unable to form a government representing all Iraq's religious and ethnic factions. There was also great unease over the al-Rafid security company, which was attacked after gunmen arrived in a convoy of vehicles, including several white SUVs and a pickup truck mounted with a heavy gun. Al-Rafid, which employs a large number of Saddam's former military officers, is one of dozens of companies providing security against the rampant violence in Iraq.
North Korea test-fired two short-range missiles yesterday. It is an unsettling reminder of the reclusive communist regime's ability to cause instability in the region where a standoff persists over its nuclear program. The development underscored the dangers posed by the country's longer-range missiles and professed nuclear weapons program. White House spokesman Scott McClellan said the U.S. government had independently confirmed that North Korea fired the two surface-to-air missiles. Hours later, the test was also confirmed by a South Korean military intelligence official who spoke on condition of anonymity due to the sensitive nature of the information. The official told the Associated Press that there had been indications of a missile launch over the past 2 days, including the transfer of equipment to the area of the launch site at Sabujin, just below the city of Kimshaek on North Korea's northeast coast. U.S. officials said North Korea should abide by its missile moratorium and that its activities demonstrated the importance of getting Pyongyang to drop its boycott of six nation talks on halting its nuclear weapons program. This has been the Cable Morning News for Thursday, February 9th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news, Cable's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, and Cable's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and Boone Rivas is on the board right now. I'm Carlos Chavez.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We welcome your participation in the AM Newsroom. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Reach us by email at amnews@kbu or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The KBU website, www.kbu.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of solid news on the KBU Evening News. Portland area weather today, snow and snow mixed with rain on the coast. Snow showers above 500 feet. Temperatures in the low 40s. Snow advisories throughout the area, mostly at higher elevations. Tonight, a chance of snow showers to the north and snow mixed with rain. Lows 30 to 40. Coming up later this morning,